Well, good afternoon to all, and good morning, and to those of you brave souls in Australia who are joining the live teleclass, it is a very early morning indeed. Welcome to you. Welcome to the Weber Training Teleclass, Evaluation and Comparison of Quality Management Systems. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, thank you very much for joining us. I will openly admit that this is a topic about which I know very little. In fact, other than some ISO experience, I've had no exposure to the theory of quality management systems whatsoever. However, some of you requested this as a teleclass topic, so it was up to me to find someone who knows the topic so well that even I will understand. Dr. Tammy Sue Lundstrom is just that person. Dr. Lundstrom is Vice President and Chief Quality and Safety Officer at the Detroit Medical Center. She is Assistant Professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases of the Department of Medicine at Wayne State University in Detroit. She was recently appointed to an APIC Steering Committee and Technical Advisory Panel. She has spoken on this topic many times and to very large audiences indeed, and it is an honor to have her join us as our faculty for this teleclass. So to present the teleclass, Evaluation and Comparison of Quality Management Systems from Wayne State University, I am pleased to present Dr. Tammy Lundstrom. Dr. Lundstrom.
Thank you, Paul. I think this is a very exciting topic about quality management systems, at least it is for me. And I think the differences, hopefully I'll be able to walk you through what the differences in some of the quality management systems are, and more importantly, what the similarities are. I think most of these systems, I think you'll see by the end, are more a philosophy of how you manage quality in your institution or your healthcare system. And there's probably no one system that's right for everybody, and no one system that will be successful 100% of the time. So it's very useful to have a flavor of the focus of the different quality management systems as you go forward and try to improve patient safety and infection control and quality in your hospitals. So if you'll turn to the first slide, again, quality management systems, really, which quality management system will work best in your institution really depends upon the flavor of your institution. Definitely institutional commitment and philosophy, strategic plan, mission, vision are very important to try to decide which quality management system is most right for you. None of these, as we know, will be successful without your top leadership support. You really need everybody singing the same tune, everybody on the same page to make any of these quality improvement efforts operational and to show how they can improve quality and save money in your facility. All of these systems require some amount of training, so I'll go through that, and at the end I've left you a list of resources where you can get additional information about all of these quality systems, including the standards for ISO. But they all do require some training and some familiarity with the lingo, because each of the quality management systems has their own lingo associated with them. I think they also differ in cost of implementation, although that's decreasing with a lot of things available online these days. There still is a cost, obviously, for training and to implement one of these systems in your facility, but as we've seen from many other efforts, quality pays. And so in the end, each of these systems can give your institution a great return on investment. The other thing that you need is buy-in from frontline staff. With any quality program, quality, customer service, infection control are everybody's responsibility in the facility, and the quality department can only do so much. For example, in infection control, I can't be there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to make sure that everybody washes their hands. It really has to be everybody's responsibility. And to make these quality management systems successful, it requires the same buy-in from frontline staff. And again, it's okay to mix and match. There's probably no system that's going to be 100% successful 100% of the time. But generally, we can learn more from our failures than we can from our successes. So if you'll turn to the next slide, I'm going to first walk through the toolboxes that are used in these various quality management systems and hopefully demonstrate to you that if you know the tools, it really doesn't matter what you call it, you can implement it in your facility. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with all of these tools using Pareto charts and run charts, control charts, radar or spider graphs, process flow diagrams, histograms, and FMEA or failure mode and effects and analysis, as well as fishbone diagrams. But I'm just going to walk through these, and then I'll go through each quality management system individually and tell you how the tools are used to accomplish the objectives of that quality management system. If you turn to the next slide, Pareto charts are useful to really display data in a way that really focuses your attention on where your top opportunities for improvement are. So it's a really great way when you're trying to prioritize activities. You really want to get the biggest bang for your buck, and that's what Pareto charts help you to do. So when you look at a Pareto chart, the display moves from a greater to lesser percentage of the total as you move from left to right. And if you look at the next slide, I've just given you a sample Pareto chart for something like medication infusion-related adverse events. So you can see in this particular Pareto chart, 25% of your adverse drug events are omitted doses of medication. Another close to 20% are monitoring or drug reaction, and then another 15% or so are wrong drug. So if you're looking to prioritize where you can get the biggest bang for your buck in terms of your medication safety program, you may want to initially focus on the omitted doses. You have to keep in mind, though, that some of the less common errors, like wrong patient or wrong dose, can actually be more detrimental to the patient than a missed dose of, for example, Maalox. So you really have to use this in light of also keeping elements of failure mode and effects analysis in the back of your mind to say what's most common may not be most likely to cause harm in patients. But it is one way to help you prioritize where you want to spend your time in performance improvement. So if you go on to the next slide is really an example of a run chart. And I'm sure all of you know that run charts are very useful to focus on performance trends over time. Very good way to display data to show improvements or lack of improvements when you're actively intervening with performance improvement initiatives. So our board particularly likes to see run charts. You'll excuse me if my Michigan allergy season kicks in and I have to clear my throat once in a while. If you go on to the next slide, this is just an example of a run chart, and this is from our performance improvement activity and looking at blood and body fluid exposures per 1,000 patient days. This is one of the things that we heavily concentrate on actually since about 1990. We have data going back to 1990, really looking at how we can continue to implement devices with engineered safety protection to decrease employee injuries in our facilities with our 1,300 employees. So you can see this is the way we like to display data to our board. They can easily see that whatever we're doing appears to be working as long as there have been no changes in our reporting structure. And we also throw on here data points of where we've implemented new devices. So it really gives our board a really quick overview of these are the devices we've implemented, this is the time frame, and this is the success we've had in decreasing our exposures with these safety devices. So very, very useful, again, to really display improvement over time when you're trying to actively intervene decrease errors in your facility or improve employee or patient safety. So if you go on to the next slide is looking at control charts. And really what you're doing with a control chart is trying to detect process variation over time. We know that we're going to have blips and dips in our data. We're not going to constantly have exact same number for some type of adverse event, and we want to know, is this more than what we would expect by chance alone? So we're going to do a control chart. Generally, using control charts, we display an upper control limit and a lower control limit, and generally those are set at 2 standard deviations above and below the mean. For some things like infection control, at least in our facilities, we set our upper and lower control limits at 1 standard deviation above and below the mean because we want to be able, since an infection control problem can lead to a large community or hospital-associated outbreak, we want to get a very quick look if something is just starting to get out of control. If we wait till we're 2 standard deviations for something like infection control, the horse may already be out of the barn by the time we act. So really it gives us just a quick way to look and see, is this something that's happening by chance alone, or is it something we need to take a little closer look at? And it helps to differentiate special cause from common cause variation, or those blips and dips that you would normally see. Is this really a downward trend or an upward trend, or is it just statistical variation? So if you go to the next slide, I didn't put a copy of a control chart in here because I'm sure you are all very, very familiar with those. But the next tool that I want to discuss is called a radar or spider graph. And this is just a snapshot of data at one point in time. So you may do this monthly to your board, for example, to really show where are we compared to where our target is. So it's very, very helpful to show in a quick way multiple measures on the same slide where do we have either positive or negative deviation from our target? Where are we performing better than expected versus worse than expected? And our board actually likes to see this. If you turn to the next page, you'll see our quality dashboard. And you can see we have multiple measures. We have 8 measures that we can display on a snapshot to our board with one slide. We have different targets for each. But if you look at the octagon that has a 1 next to it, if we're below 1, we're performing better than our target. If we're above 1, we're performing above our target or not as well as the target that we've set internally. So if you look at, for this one example, emergency department, LWBS, which is left without being seen, you can see that at this time our goal was 2.99 per 100 visits. And what we were achieving was 2.99 per 100 visits, and our goal was 1 per 100 visits or less. So we really weren't achieving our targets. So taking this information, we developed a 29-minute ER guarantee where we would see every patient within 29 minutes. A physician would see every patient within 29 minutes of arrival. And we now have about 1 per 1,000 emergency department left without being seen visits, which took a whole reengineering of our emergency department. So it's a really, spider graph or radar graph is a really, really quick way to display to your board or whoever you're talking to multiple measures at the same time, and how are you doing compared to benchmarks or compared to the targets that you've set internally. Next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about process flow diagrams. And really, process flow diagrams are used very frequently, excuse me, both in performing root cause analysis and in performing failure mode and effects analysis. So really what a process flow diagram is just a mapping of steps in a process, like, for example, medication administration. And with every step, you might have multiple sub-steps, and I'll give you an example of that in a few minutes. Really, what we like to use it for is, again, in root cause analysis, which is a look at an event that occurred, an adverse event that occurred, or a near miss that occurred in a patient to say, what went wrong? How can we prevent this from happening again? And we also use it in a slightly different way in a failure modes and effects analysis, where we're looking at this is something that could occur in our facility. We want to redesign care to make it safer, so we're going to do a process flow for that. And I'll give you examples of the differences between the two. So what we often use it at to do is to compare the process as written versus the process as performed. For example, you can have the best policy in the world, but if nobody is following it because it doesn't fit into the workflow, it's really a useless policy. So what you can do to test your policy and see how it fits into the real world is to do a process flow for the steps outlined in your policy, and then go up to a real unit and see how the policy is actually practiced and compare the differences between the steps or the ideal policy versus the real world to find where you need to modify to either improve safety or reduce unnecessary steps, both of which can be integrated into your quality program. And again, this tool is used by multiple different quality management systems. So if you go on to the next slide, this is an example of a process flow. So I've made a decision to place a central venous catheter. I have to obtain patient consent and mark the catheter site. I need to assemble my supplies. I need to insert the central venous catheter using appropriate aseptic technique. Then the RN generally has to perform site care using aseptic technique. Later on, I have to assess the patient for signs and symptoms of infection, document the patient assessment, communicate the patient assessment to the next caregiver, and then decide if further assessment is warranted. So if you look at each of these steps in the process, can have multiple sub-steps. For example, in assembling supplies, this is actually one that we use to reduce our bloodstream catheter-associated infection rate close to zero for many months in our ICU. If you look at assembling the supplies, there are multiple sub-steps under assembling supplies. I have to assemble the catheter tray. I have to assemble the prep. I have to get the sterile drapes and the gowns and gloves and mask, et cetera, that all go in to using full barrier precautions to insert a central venous catheter. And then I may have to get additionally a safety device, for example, a stat lock to secure my central venous catheter so I don't have to suture it in place. So previously, if you look at all the steps in the process, we do have to go 5 or 6 places to assemble all the materials that we would need to put in a central venous catheter. because of doing this this process flow, we said, you know, it would be much more efficient and things will much more likely to be used if we bundle all of the supplies that we need for insertion of the central venous catheter together in one packet. So now you can go and pull one, go to one place, pull one packet, and get everything you need to insert a central venous catheter appropriately. And I'll talk about this in the Toyota production model, because reducing wasted steps is one of these things that you look to improve in Toyota production model. And really, if you have to go six places to get supplies, you're really wasting staff time and not being as efficient as you could be, resulting in a lot of process failures because people are not generally going to go to six places to get all the supplies they need. If you go on to the next slide, looking at histograms really demonstrates a frequency distribution is commonly used to diagram outbreaks. So I just showed a very simple one with all the attention internationally through World Health Organization and Institute for Healthcare Improvement, as well as in the U.S. from JACO on hand-washing compliance, just looking at how many times on all the time periods that we observed did we see patients appropriately washing hands. So just really a simple simple bar graph looking at percent compliance as opposed to number of observations actually conducted. If you go on to the next slide then, I'm going to talk about failure mode and effects analysis. Again, failure mode and effects analysis is really a proactive risk assessment. Generally, you would term it a root cause analysis if an event has actually occurred that caused patient harm. But you might have an event that occurs that is just a process redesign. For example, we used failure mode and effects analysis when we were moving a hospital. So we would go in and say, okay, this is the process as it's done in our current facility with our current facility structure and setup and modules and where the rooms are. This is how we think it's going to work in our new facility. And then really go over and test in our new facility what kind of things are we going to have to change in the process of a code because the structural setup of the unit was different. Another place where we use this very successfully is implementation of our electronic medical record. We just launched a month ago CPOE and nursing documentation at one of our facilities. And what we did is for every single care process, whether it was nursing, clerical, lab, ancillary services, radiology, dietary, et cetera, physician care, physician ordering process, we went through, mapped out each and every process as it currently occurred, and then decided what we were going to start, stop, or continue with our electronic process. So we could really identify beforehand where failures might occur as we transition to an electronic medical record and take steps to mitigate those so no harm would come to the patients. So you're really looking with FEMA to find the source of the problems before they occur so you can change the process proactively to prevent harm to patients. We've also used it, for example, if there's a description of something that occurred in another facility that hits the paper, we've all had those moments when we say, oh my goodness, that could easily happen here, let me take a look. We've used a FEMA actually to improve our process. For example, several years ago, there was an outbreak of pneumonia from leaky bronchoscopes at a facility in the United States. And what happened is the recall notice for the bronchoscopes got to the loading dock, but it really never got to the clinicians who were actually using the bronchoscopes or to infection control. So we took that opportunity when that hit the newspapers to say, my goodness, that could happen here with our recall process as well. Used failure mode and effects analysis to totally redesign our recall process to try to prevent that event from ever occurring in our facility. So if you go on to the next slide, it'll tell you, talk about the development and methodology when you're doing a failure mode and effects analysis. If you're doing a process that's huge, like medication administration process, you really have to narrow the scope because there are generally about 60 or 70 steps in the total medication administration process, from physician deciding to order a particular medicine to transcription to transmittal to pharmacy verification to medication arrives on the unit, to nurse administration, to monitoring the patient after the medication is given. So you really want to narrow that scope because a failure mode and effects analysis is very, very detailed. You couldn't possibly handle all of that in one chunk. So you want to take it off into many failure mode, small failure mode and effects analysis that go over months to try to really figure out to go through the whole process, because otherwise they'll just get lost in the process. For example, for our recall process, what we did is we decided that we were just going to look at notifying departments when there was a recall notice that came in. So where are the points of entry where a recall notice could come in? How was it transmitted to logistics department? How was it communicated out from logistics, and how did we assure that we had no recalled supplies or medications on the units? And we decided that that's where we would focus. Our recall process was on the event notification to start. So every year we chipped away at the recall process, where most of our vulnerabilities were, until we had completely redesigned the whole process. The next thing you want to do is always establish a time frame, because it keeps you on track. It's really important for these, all of these quality improvement projects, to set yourself a deadline. If you have to veer from the deadline for any reason, because things do occur, make sure that you set a new deadline and try to explain to your quality committee why you needed to deviate. Document the rationale. Why are we doing this FEMA in the first place? Establish a team. Establish leadership support. Identify your information needs and document your communication plans. So I'm just going to show you the next slide, actually, is the form that we use to document our FEMA development and methodology. So who is going to take the lead on this? When did it start, and how soon do we want to complete this? Then we want to look from the process flow of the entire process, do we need to narrow the scope? If our scope is too broad, we're going to get lost in the details and not be able to accomplish what we set out to do. So if it's a very complicated process with 70 or 80 steps, we may focus on a portion of the process, like actual meds administration to the patient or pharmacy verification as a way to get started. We want to make sure that we document the rationale for why we're doing this failure mode and effects analysis, because there are estimates that every failure mode and effects analysis that you do takes about 160 hours of staff time total to be able to accomplish it. So you really want to do something where you're going to get the bang for that 160 hours of staff time. So we check in our failure mode and effects analysis, why are we doing this? Are we doing it because we've identified a near miss from our own incident reporting system? We have internal data that show that lapses occur frequently, and if they do occur, they can be severe. We have external data like the recall notification that we found from another facility, and we know that it could easily happen here, so we want to take a look at that. Or are we developing a new facility, moving facilities, implementing new equipment, et cetera. So new process, procedure, or technology that we're implementing in our facilities. So if you look at the next slide, the first thing we start to do is gather information. We want to look at our own internal procedures, guidelines, protocols. We want to look at anything we can get externally, any guidelines from any websites or facilities in our area who are dealing with the same problem. Look to a literature search for best practices. Also, professional organizations and societies for resource lists and guidelines. And then the staff or departments that we need to interview or involve regarding the process. And you'll notice that we make sure that we put a name attached with each of these so we know who is it assigned to and when are they due to complete their task to really keep us on track. If you go to the next slide, then the next thing we do is construct the flow diagram. For a root cause analysis, you're really looking at a chronological flow, which is what happened in what sequence for a root cause analysis. But again, for a failure mode and effects analysis, similar to the process flow I showed you, you're really looking at how the process should flow in your facility and not what are the steps that happened in this individual case. Again, it's important to make sure that whatever you think the process flow is actually what's occurring on the units. And that's why it's so critical to involve people who have some knowledge of the process you're trying to look at. If the process is complex, again, you have to narrow the focus so that you can actually complete it in a reasonable amount of time, and then identify all the sub-processes under each process step. If you go to the next slide, then what we do is try to identify the failure modes. What might go wrong? What could go wrong at each step or sub-step? Why would this go wrong? So how could it go? What might happen? How could it go wrong? Why would the failure occur? And what happens if failure occurs at this step? Is it going to lead to patient death? Is it going to lead to a severe catastrophic outcome? The next page actually is our documentation form. So we've got our process flow and our processes all numbered. And our sub-process is all lettered, so we'll have process step 1A, 1B, 1C, 2, 3, 4A, B, C. We go through and we look at the step number, the process number or sub-process number. Again, the failure modes. What might happen at this step? How could this fail? What could go wrong? Likely cause? Why would failure occur at this step, effect, what would happen when failure occurs at this step, and then assign a severity and a probability score, which I'll talk about in a moment, to get our hazard score. And then our final column is what actions are we going to take to eliminate or reduce failure at this step in the process. So going on to how to assign the hazard score, it's a combination of the severity score and the probability score. And the reason we want to assign a hazard score is it's a way to help you prioritize. You're not going to change every step or sub-step in the process. Only those that are most critical to a successful outcome, whatever that outcome may happen to be. So you're going to look at severity rating. We rate on a scale of 1 to 4, where 1 is a minor event and 4 is a catastrophic event where a patient's going to have death or major permanent loss of function. If you go to the next slide, then we look at the probability score. And this is telling us how likely is this going to occur in our facility. Is it something that happens once in a blue moon, so it would be a 1, or is it something that happens very frequently, immediately or at least several times in a year? Then we take, on the next slide, you can see we've taken the probability score and the severity score, multiplied those two to get a hazard score. And what we've set as our cutoff for our failure modes and effects analysis is that everything with an 8 or greater hazard score must be addressed. The probability of failure is high, and the severity or the outcome for the patient is likely to be negative if we miss something at this step. So this is something we're absolutely going to address. Anything with an hazard score of 8 or less, we may address or we may not, depending on time. We may just deal with the most critical issues first and then deal with the lesser issues later on, or perhaps not at all if we've built in redundancies in our system. The next thing we want to do is for all those with a score of 8 or greater, we're going to describe or try to brainstorm about how that failure can be avoided, eliminated, or reduced. And then once we do that, we want to construct the redesigned process flow, test it, communicate the action plan, and include a time frame. And then we want to very critically develop measures at each step in the process, or at least of the overall outcome, to say, how are we going to know that this process redesign was actually successful and accomplished improved patient safety, reduced infection, or whatever else our outcome may be. So it's really important, for example, for our central venous catheter insertion redesign, we want to look at process. How many times did we use all full barrier precautions? How many times did we wash our hands appropriately? How many times did we use the appropriate dressing as some of our process measures? And then our ultimate outcome measure is, did we reduce our central venous catheter-associated infection rate? So if you go on to the next slide, finally, I'm going to talk about the Ishikawa or fishbone diagram. It's really a cause and effect diagram used in a root cause analysis to really display the causes of a problem that may have occurred. So if you look at the next slide, for example, in the central venous catheter, continuing on with the same theme, if I had a patient who developed a bloodstream infection as a result of an inappropriately placed catheter or a catheter where all the appropriate processes weren't followed, what are the things that I'd have to consider? Patient, staff, environment, materials. So something could go wrong environmentally with the skin prep, with aseptic technique or availability of supplies, that I need to look at the root causes of failure at this step. Materials, dressing changes, maybe I selected the wrong catheter in the first place, staffing levels, staff competency, education, and then patient factors that may have led to an adverse outcome. It's just a way of displaying things, again, a kind of a quick look at the root causes of a failed process. If you go on to the next slide, I'm really going to start talking now about 4 different quality management systems, Six Sigma, Baldrige, ISO, and Toyota production model, and tell you what is the overall philosophy of this quality management system, and what are the tools out of my toolbox that I now have that I'm going to use most commonly under that quality philosophy. So if you go to Six Sigma, The goal with Six Sigma is to eliminate defects in existing processes. And what you're trying to achieve is 3 to 4 defects per million or less with Six Sigma. And in most of our facilities, we think that 80 to 90% is pretty darn good, but that's only 10 to the minus 1, not 10 to the minus 6 in terms of safety. So we really haven't achieved anywhere near Six Sigma with most of our processes in healthcare. Six Sigma also focuses, as many of the quality methodologies do, on really achieving your customer expectations. And the goal with Six Sigma is to really try to pick projects that will achieve a return on investment because, again, it's an intensive process. You want to try to achieve cost savings of at least $250,000 with each Six Sigma process or project. Again, if you look at the next slide, this is just an example of where we are in healthcare. We're at 1 to 2 failures per 10 for things like beta blockers for acute myocardial infarction, where we have the Six Sigma goal, 10 to the minus 6, or 1 or 2 failures per million as a Six Sigma goal. And most things in healthcare were far from that. 1 failure per 100 for medication administration, 1 failure per 1,000 for general surgery, deaths, 1 per 10,000 to, in some cases, per 100,000 for anesthesia-related deaths. So anesthesia is probably the closest process in healthcare that's gotten towards, but not quite achieved, the Six Sigma goal. The structure for Six Sigma in the facility is to have a series of belts similar to karate. Your master black belt is the highest level that you can achieve in Six Sigma. So you start out with a process owner, a master black belt, which is generally an external consultant, a black belt, which is a full-time person who works on only 4 to 6 projects annually. And I don't know about you, but certainly I'd love it if I was working on only 4 to 6 projects annually. I'm sure I could achieve more than I do now. The training is generally was previously from a really intensive training session, cost approximately $25,000 per black belt training, but a lot of training now, especially for green belts, is really available online, which you can do at your own time, and probably less expensive than when I put this slide together. A green belt is kind of your novice, a green or a white belt that you're working into learning the Six Sigma methodology, and they assist the black belt, but they still maintain their usual job responsibilities. If you look at the next slide, then the Six Sigma process is really, again, starting out with defining the problem. You have to have some measure of current performance with any quality improvement project because you need to know if your interventions actually made a difference. Use root cause analysis a lot then to explore root causes of problems and also the best practices similar to failure mode and effects analysis where we do our literature search up front. We want to then design the new process, validate, and implement and measure success. And the tools from our toolbox that we use very, very commonly for Six Sigma would be process flow and failure mode and effects analysis methodology. And that is why you only have 4 to 6 projects a year as a black belt because of the intense time involved in really carrying out a failure mode and effects analysis. If you go on to the next slide, we're going to move on to talk about Toyota Production Model. And the focus of Toyota Production Model is to eliminate waste or redundancy. And again, heavy focus, as all these quality management systems do, on your customer needs. So what you want to do is eliminate any extra steps in the process that don't add value from the customer perspective. So you want to reduce waste and inefficiency to give your customer the best product with the least cost and the least waste that you can do. So if you go on to the next slide, some of the sources of waste in healthcare are, for example, transportation, transporting samples to a lab. Searching for equipment, very common in healthcare. Waiting, admission delays, delays in being seen by a doctor in the emergency department, for example, going back to my emergency department left without being seen example. Processing, unnecessary testing. I'm doing two chest x-rays a day apart because I can't find the initial chest x-ray. That's waste from a customer's perspective, certainly, both wasted time and wasted processing. You might have wasted inventory or supplies. Excuse me. You might deal with overproduction. We're doing early testing to avoid lab delays, or because it takes so long to get a routine back, the doctors are ordering everything stat, which is overwhelming the lab. You also want to look at corrections, because anytime you have to retest to verify a result that you don't believe, retesting due to error, that's certainly a waste. And then looking at defects like falls and medication errors. The next slide shows you the Toyota production model process principles. Again, eliminate waste, improve workflow, optimize inventory so you don't have those wasted supplies, change your work environment to eliminate waste. So instead of getting supplies for a central venous catheter insertion from six different places, I can pull everything in one location. With one pull from the shelf, I get everything I need instead of six trips to different places. Really focuses on customer needs and enhancing customer relationships, managing time and variation, and designing systems to avoid waste. So the next slide, similar to Six Sigma, use a lot of process mapping in Toyota production model because you really want to eliminate those unneeded steps. And the only way to do that is map out what actually occurs versus what will occur if I cut out all the wasted steps. You also use a lot of Pareto charts to really try to focus your activities where you're going to get the most efficiency for your intervention. Again, control charts to find out where do I want to focus my energy? Are the blips and dips I'm seeing just normal statistical variation, or is something out of control that I need to intervene? A lot of cause and effect diagrams and failure mode and effects analysis. Again, the lingo is really important in these quality management systems. For TPM, you've got Kaizen. Kai is break apart to make, and Zen is to make it better. So Kaizen is really utilizing your process flow to identify and eliminate those unnecessary steps in the process. If you go on to Malcolm Baldrige, actually Malcolm Baldrige is a U.S. award. It's a national quality award bestowed by the president, and for the first time in 1999, it was applied to healthcare. The first healthcare facility actually took 7 years to achieve success, so this is not a journey that you're going to make in a year. This is a long-term strategy that you would put in your quality strategic plan as something you want to achieve 5 to 7 years down the road. And for Malcolm Baldrige, you use external examiners. There's really seven main foci of the Baldrige process. Really, leadership is key, as they are in all quality management systems, addressing good citizenship for the institution. Strategic planning is really key, setting the direction, strategic direction and action plans, And not only setting them as a leader, but making sure that everybody in the organization understands what the objectives of the strategic plan are. Also heavily customer-focused, trying to determine expectations of customers and focus on customer satisfaction. Obviously, with all of these systems, to measure is to manage. Baldridge also focuses, though, on the next slide, on human resources, really enabling the workforce to develop its full potential. So, for example, in our facility, anybody, we call it anybody can stop the train, plane, or automobile. So if anybody sees anybody not following policy, not using central venous catheter appropriate steps, full sterile barriers, not washing their hands before touching a patient, anybody can challenge anybody and say, stop. Just like in the airline industry, anybody who sees an unsafe process is empowered to be able to stop the train and redirect things in a safe way. Looks at process design, management, and improvement in terms of strategic planning, and also business results, looking at your performance in business areas relative to your competition and trying to improve. So the Baldridge process, generally you work with a consultant to assist with the assessment of your facility and then application. Here's where the gaps are. Here's what we need to work on to be able to achieve the Baldridge criteria. And then you use examiners to provide feedback to the organization for performance improvement. I'm going to move on for the next slide into ISO. Really, ISO, again, has a quality management system. It's standards-based, highly utilized outside of the U.S. for healthcare organizations, and there's now a company within the U.S. that has applied for Medicare, Medicaid deemed status. If that's approved in the summer of this year, ISO would be an alternative to things like Joint Commission and AOA for hospital accreditation. It's a series really of internal and external audits that are used for continuous improvement in the facility. And if you go on the next slide, ISO, like all of the quality management systems, is very customer-focused. But you're dealing not only with your external customers, meaning patients, but also payors and internal customers as well. A lot of emphasis on process design and planning for new activities, planning for new programs, etc. Heavy focus on providing employees work instructions and guidelines that are set by top administration in order to minimize variation. Focus on leadership and management communication of expectations and strategic plan and objectives and targets to all employees. So leadership involvement, like in all of these systems, is key. And all of the employees, when they're audited, must know what is their particular role in achieving the quality objectives. So, for example, in our facility, we are ISO certified for a quality management system across our healthcare system. One of our strategic goals is to decrease employee blood and body fluid exposures. So all employees need to be able to articulate to the surveyors how they are helping the facility or the health system achieve its goal of improving employee safety. The ISO process is adapted from the manufacturing industry, and there's a document that's available in the references that I've given you to really interpret the ISO standards for utilization in not the heel care industry, but the healthcare industry. Facilities generally hire a consultant for training and education, although we did not. When we decided to go down the ISO road, we did it internally with with our internal quality resources, and took about 6 weeks or so to really prepare ourselves for the first ISO external audit. Really utilize process flow, heavy utilization of failure mode and effects analysis, run charts and Pareto, and all the other tools that you've used in your toolbox. The internal audits really, you train internal auditors to perform scheduled audits of all standards, all departments, and really the focus is on continual readiness and continual performance improvement, and then you developed a corrective action for each nonconformance that you find in your internal audits. And then at least annually, you have external surveillance audits, and every 3 years, a full registration audit, where you have external auditors come in and survey your facility against the ISO standards. So in conclusion, for the quality management systems, I'll say that they're all very effective, can be very effective with the appropriate resources and leadership support. All of them utilize the same toolbox. So if you know these tools inside and out and when to use them, you can be successful no matter what you call it. Each of the quality management systems has its own lingo that needs to be adopted for healthcare, and what I would recommend is that it's much easier in our facility. We teach our external ISO auditors what is our lingo. This is what we mean by objective and target, and give them a glossary translating ISO terms into what we use, instead of training our employees to speak ISOese. None of these will be successful without leadership commitment, and the cost and focus really varies depending upon the system chosen. Again, the following slides are just some resources that you might find useful to really further investigate some of these quality management systems. And with that, I think we have a few minutes for questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lundstrom. I actually think that I have a shadow of an understanding of these things now. You mentioned something that I found very fascinating. In the Baldrige system, you mentioned that anybody can challenge anybody if they see them doing a process or a system incorrectly. Is this something that you actually have in your culture, and how long could it possibly have taken to build a culture like that where people are willing to challenge each other?
Well, I think it's unique in healthcare. It's not so unique in, for example, the airline industry, and we actually use the same philosophy in ISO. We started out about 3 years ago now to really develop within our ICUs this philosophy where a clerk could challenge a physician, a nurse could challenge a physician could challenge a nurse, et cetera. So anybody, when they saw something unsafe being done, could just say, stop, can we confer? And then redirect that person to the appropriate policy. What we needed to do is we needed to first really sit down with all of the staff together from clerk to physician and say, this is what we're going to do. This is what we want to try to accomplish to improve patient safety, because we're all busy. We all can get distracted and forget to do the right thing. So don't see it as a reprimand. See it as a reminder to do the best thing for the patient, which is what we're all about. We also had a physician available at all times to be able to counsel other physicians. If the physician was challenged and made a fuss, we wanted immediate backup for the clerical staff and the nursing staff to be able to tell that physician they did absolutely the right thing and isn't this great, and really redirect their behavior.
Wow.
So we started out about 3 years ago now, and we're actually great in our ICUs. We've had not as much success in our ORs, some success in our EDs, and we're really working to expand the concept outside of our intensive care units to our emergency departments and ORs. But what we've done is we have a, in one in one of our, it's worked in all of our facilities to varying degrees. In several of our facilities, we've had up to 6 months, in some cases 7 months, with no bloodstream infections, no
wow.
ventilator-associated pneumonias, through a combination of bundling, reducing steps, simplifying the process, and having a culture where anybody could challenge anybody.
And it should be said, yours is not a small hospital either.
No, actually, it's worked from our community 100-bed hospital to our university tertiary care 500-bed hospital, which has 10 floors of ICU towers. So it's really been successful, even in our acute rehab facility. So, again, applied to multiple different hospitals with different cultures. And I think once you can get everybody to understand that we're all here to do the best for the patient, it really can advance things.
Wow, that's fabulous. Thank you. Thank you to everyone for joining this teleclass. A special thanks to Dr. Lundstrom, who, despite having been on her feet for almost 36 hours now, gave an outstanding presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.